Welcome to another chapter of Family Fiction's Christian Fiction Bookshelf Podcast, where we give you a deeper look into your favorite Christian authors and the inspirations, research, and methodology that goes into writing the books you love to read. Here's your host, Jamie Vaughn.
Hello and welcome to the next chapter of the Christian Fiction Bookshelf. I'm your host, Jamie Vaughn. This chapter of the Christian Fiction Bookshelf podcast is sponsored by Revell, a division of Baker Publishing Group. And today we have with us Suzanne Woods Fisher, who's here to talk to us about her brand new book, The Moonlight School. Hi, Suzanne. How are you?
Hi, Jamie. I'm fine. And thank you for having me today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. We're really excited that you're here. Now, your latest book, I would love to hear more about The Moonlight School.
Okay, well, The Moonlight School is based on a true story, and I love actually even how I even came across this story, because I wake up early in the morning, and I listen to a classical music station as I write, mm-hmm. and there was this one morning, and I think it was a September 5th day, that the radio host made a comment, and he said, "Today on this day in 1911, the Moonlight School's grassroots movement got started," and there was something about that that just caught my attention, and I just immediately Googled it. I went and found out a little bit more about it. Then I actually called my editor. She got as excited as I was. And then it wasn't much longer before we had a contract in the mail. And that's kind of the spark for the story. But the story, to answer your question, is about a woman named Cora Wilson Stewart. So we're in Rowan County, Kentucky in 1911, eastern part of Appalachia. It's a remote, isolated mountainous area. Poor. It had the national illiteracy rate in 1910, the U.S. Census, was about 7.7%. The entire United States population was unable to read or write their name in any language. Rowan County was over 25%, and probably even much further than that, because it was so isolated and so out, you know, hard to get people. And they also have a great suspicion of the government, and so they weren't exactly open to reveal themselves. Anyway, Cora Wilson Stewart had this idea of opening the schoolhouses on moonlit nights to illiterate adults. Mm-hmm. She was responsible for over 51 schoolhouses, rural, way out, one-room schoolhouses. And she had to persuade her school teachers, who had taught children all day long, to stay in the night for these night schools. And it happened in the fall. That's really when usually farming families, that's when they have a little more time. Mm-hmm. She hoped that maybe 150 people would come. And would you believe that first night, September 5th, 1911, over 1,200 people came out of the hills and the hollows to fill these schoolhouses, ages 18 to 86, mothers with babies, old men. They were so motivated to learn to read and write. And within 2 years, she wiped out adult illiteracy in her county. It spread through Kentucky, then into the states, the southern states, and then into Native American reservations. I'm really taking a long time to answer your question, but it was just such an incredible true story, almost like an unsung hero of this woman. And I just had to bring it to story form.
Yeah. Well, you answered my next question beautifully without knowing it. What drew you to the story? So I would love to hear more about the main character in this book, Lucy Wilson. And, you know, she's tasked with helping these students out, you know, these adults who have become students. What was your inspiration for Lucy?
Well, I have the sort of the bones of the story mm-hmm. already. And I already just even told you it. So it's not a spoiler. Right. It really just came, it almost gave me the skeleton. And now I needed to fill in. Mm-hmm. And every story needs a love story. Every story. I mean, even think of war stories, they have love stories. The only story I can think of without a love story is To Kill a Mockingbird. But really almost every story, it contains love. Cora Wilson Stewart was married three times and divorced three times, twice to the same man. She had a difficult time with abusive men, you know, and I think it came to a point in her life when she realized marriage was not going to be her passion, but her work was, and it was. But I didn't want to change that about her. I thought that was who she was. I was really trying to write a story that was brought her to life, mm-hmm. this bold, charismatic personality. I needed an offset. I needed someone to reveal more about Cora. I needed a love story. I needed a reason to keep going in the story as well, because you already knew what the outcome was with the schoolhouses being filled. So enter Lucy Wilson, and she is a second cousin to Cora. She and her father, and she's a fictitious character, were cousins raised together in Rowan County. Cora's from Rowan County. And Lucy's father left, did not want to look back. He was done with the poverty of Appalachia. He raised his family in Lexington, Kentucky. His daughter was protected from anything to do with Appalachia. He really looked down on it. But Cora talked him into letting Lucy, who'd been very protected, very sheltered, to be sort of her assistant. Well, Lucy arrives so naive and overwhelmed by the poverty, things she had never experienced in her life. And it took the sort of the fun of the book was watching her get past the obvious signs of poverty to see the beauty of the culture and the traditions and the community that supported each other and the music and all the parts of things that she couldn't see because she was only seeing the veneer. She wasn't looking past that.
Was there anything in your research of this book that surprised you?
Well, something that I find interesting in studying, especially women who break the mold, like Cora Wilson Stewart or some other main characters I've written in historical fiction, the thinking of the day, the academic thinking of the day, which Cora accepted, was that adults could not learn to read and write. The window was open in childhood, and when it closed, it closed. And she accepted that. That was pretty much the way people thought. There were three moments in her life around 1910, 1911, that shook her. And I wrote them into the story because they were really pivotal moments for her to just almost wake her up to another way of thinking. And she did. And that's why she came up with this idea of the Moonlight Schools. And she did not teach adults using children primers. She created reading material that was relevant to them, farming information, weather, because farmers always talk about weather and things like that. And she did not humiliate or demean them in any way, but she brought to life their how words could mean something to them. So I think that was the joy of it, was looking at the fact that she broke through conventional thinking for the common good. It wasn't for her own personal significance. It was to see a better way. And she did it and had to persevere. And I'm sure she had a lot of pushback. Mm-hmm. But that was exciting. I think another thing to add to that was just, I just think the power of words, the power of reading is enormous and something we take for granted. And it is, when you can't read and write, you don't have a voice. You don't have the ability to function in this world. And it's just as true today as it was in 1911, as it was thousands of years ago.
What do you want the reader to take away from this book?
Well, that ties into something that was a powerful moment for me in doing research, where if we looked at the 1910 U.S. Census, where 7.7 of the population in America couldn't read or write, you would naturally assume that over the last 100 plus years, that statistic would be lower and lower and lower. And Jamie, it is higher and higher and higher, three times what it was. Wow. 21% of Americans are functionally illiterate. They can't read a newspaper. They can't read a medicine bottle. It is a troubling discovery. And our country has so many problems. I don't mean to add one more into the mix. But I mean, for example, the prison population, it's like 75% of inmates are unable to really read at a level that they can hold jobs or pursue a livelihood. Youth offenders, it's huge. I think it's like 85% are really struggling. There's so many reasons for it. You know, the poverty is such a large part of it. Immigration, but of course our country's always been full of immigration and immigrants who, so it goes, I'm not saying there's any easy fix. It's just that it is a really startling thing. And I almost feel as if there's a phrase among literacy advocates, each one teach one. Mm-hmm. And I love that because it just gives you the sense of, okay, I can do something about this. Even if it's donating books to your school library, it's helping a teacher. I have girlfriends who donate an hour a week at the public library, not obviously during COVID, but right, prior and after. They look forward to getting back to it, where they're working with immigrants who are trying to learn and to become fluent in English. I have a little free library outside of my house where it's become kind of a watering hole for the neighborhood. I think reading to your children, reading to your grandchildren, it's modeling the value of books and the importance of it. So I think that's the biggest takeaway, is the feeling like, do not take this for granted. If you can read, thank a teacher and keep reading and encourage the gift of reading among others.
Do you have any helpful tips of how we can get involved in helping fight illiteracy?
Well, like I mentioned, I think it's easy to do in your neighborhood or even in your community. I think, for example, I'm kind of wondering about getting involved with local prisons if you live anywhere near one. I think probably that would be a profoundly impactful ministry to try to bring literacy to those who are illiterate behind bars. That may not be for everyone, but I think helping out at your local school, or like I said, just donating books, you know, not just keeping them in your bookshelves growing dusty, but share them and get them out there.
And what lessons as Christians can we learn from this book? How did you weave Christ throughout it?
Well, I think one of the things I try to do in my books is to not necessarily whack people on the head with the Bible. I really want it to be a quiet invitation to understand that God is present. So the value of these individuals, I think, was probably the most powerful moment there, that God relentlessly pursues each one of us and longs to bring people into the fold. And the ability to read is the ability to read scripture. If we can't read, we're missing out on something so powerful, so life-changing, so transformative.
Suzanne, thank you so much for coming by and talking to us today. And everyone, please make sure to go and pick up from your local bookstore, your Christian bookstore, online, wherever you buy your books, The Moonlight School. And we are excited to see what happens with it next. And thank you, everyone, for joining today for the Christian Fiction Bookshelf podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Vaughn. And thank you, Suzanne Woods Fisher, for joining us today to talk about The Moonlight School. And there are more details below in the chapter notes. And if you like this chapter of the Christian Fiction Bookshelf podcast, click below and subscribe so you don't miss another chapter.
Thanks for listening to Family Fiction's Christian Fiction Bookshelf podcast. Stay up to date on all things Christian fiction at familyfiction.com. Christian Fiction Bookshelf is produced by Ross Kluver, hosted by Jamie Vaughn, and edited by Brandon Woolham. Subscribe today wherever you listen to podcasts so you'll never miss a chapter.